Hello and welcome to The Human Interface, brought to you by the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford. This is a podcast about how developments in technology impact our work and life, as told through the research and insights of a brilliant roster of experts and industry practitioners from the university and beyond. I'm your host, Veena McCool. This episode explores the future of cultural labor under platform capitalism. While it's never been easier for musicians to release music, the economics of the music industry and online streaming mean earning a living has become even more challenging. Dr. Sanok Lee is a sociologist at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. She's currently working on a project that examines digital platform workers and the gig economy in South Korea and the Netherlands. Dr. Robert Prey is an associate professor of digital culture at the OII. At the University of Groningen, he is principal investigator of a European Research Council-funded project that investigates how streaming and social media platforms influence the creative practices, identities, and working conditions of musicians around the world. Sanok and Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
I would love to start with kind of an understanding of what it even means to be a musician today and how this might have changed over time.
Yeah, well, first of all, there are many different types of musicians, right? There are hobbyists who just play guitar in the evening. There are musicians who belong to the London Symphony Orchestra, right? In our research, we mainly focus on music artists who are trying to make a living in popular music genres. So for much of the 20th century, this meant you had to try to get a record deal, right? You would be discovered playing in a little cellar somewhere or in a garage, and then you'd get signed, and the record company would get you into a studio to record an album, and then hopefully one of your singles would be played on the radio. So this was a really industrial system with all kinds of gates and filters. This system has been disrupted for good and for bad over the past 20 years or so. And technology plays a big role in this disruption. What we had, like peer-to-peer file sharing. Some of you might remember Napster. And we have, over the last 30 or so odd years, cheaper versions of digital audio workstations, which allow musicians to produce outside of studios. But I would say that music streaming really opened the floodgates.
Yeah. It's never been easy to find music and listen to music from around the world or from different periods of history. So when I think back to how I listened to music growing up in South Korea in the 90s, it doesn't really feel like a different world. Now we just tap a screen and any song appears. But back then, music took effort and a kind of small ritual. In the 90s, the main way to listen to music was buying physical albums, mostly at the time, CDs, and before that, cassette tapes. So I remember saving, my pocket money just to buy a new album from my favorite artist, like Seotaeji and Boys in South Korea. It was a really huge. Going into the music shop or stopping by street vendors who sold illegal cassette tapes that were very common at the time in South Korea. Mm. And then when I got home, I'd put the disc into my Discman or the tape in my Walkman. So, some small little cassette tape player. And then somehow listening felt more personal that way. So cassette tapes were everywhere before CD took over, right? Maybe nowadays people don't remember anymore, though. So I used to record songs from the radio and waiting with my finger on the record button, hoping the DJ wouldn't talk over the intro as well. So I made mixtapes, quite a lot of work. And so I put whatever songs I like onto one tape. So sometimes I even make copies of mixtapes as a birthday gift for my friends as well. So in Korea, actually, the TV was also a huge part of how people discovered music, at least for me. So weekend music shows were basically requiring viewing. And strangely, I learned a lot of Western pop songs from TV commercials.
No.
I still remember the first time I heard Radiohead's Creep. It wasn't from the radio or an album, but from a TV commercial. A lot of pop songs entered my life like that. So I just suddenly appearing on TV. I remember in the early 2000s, everything changed with the P2P sites like Soribada in South Korea. Literal meaning is the sea of sounds. So people certainly downloaded MP3s, and mostly, again, illegal. But though, no one around me really thought about it is illegal or legal, because that time we didn't have the concept. So it felt like some kind of revolution, by the way. So, and then MP3 players came along, and the music became portable in completely new way. So it was quite big changes. But I want to say, interesting fact, many people think that Spotify was the first subscription streaming service, but it was actually South Korean streaming service, Melon. So they introduced their subscription service way back in 2004. So South Korea became the first country where revenue from digital music surpassed physical music. So it's been over 20 years already.
Yeah, I think back to when I had to ask my mom to pay 99 cents for a song on iTunes or whatever, and thinking about the way that streaming is such a normal part of how we all consume music and podcasts. Has streaming ruined music? Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, I think it's pretty impossible, luckily, to ruin music. And it's certainly not possible for one technology like streaming to do it on its own. But I think it's highly plausible that streaming has changed music, just like other technologies of distribution before it have, like radio changed music, or video, which apparently killed a radio star. So that's one of the arguments made by Liz Pelly in a recent book called Mood Music that's gotten a lot of attention. But I would say that one thing that is, I think, indisputable, that it's becoming increasingly hard for musicians to earn a living from the sales of recorded music. Now, it's always been hard. The music industry was always a very exploitative and difficult industry to make a career out of. But nowadays, most artists see very little revenue from the recordings. And one of the reasons for this is because of how streaming services pay royalties. We tend to think that they pay a certain fixed rate per stream, you know, maybe half a penny or so. But actually, it's called the pro rata model, which is a somewhat confusing model to explain, so I'll do it very briefly. It's like the share of a pie, right? Your piece of the pie. So if you, as an artist, if your songs make up about 1% of all the songs streamed on a service like Spotify in a given month, then you receive 1% of all the revenue or the royalties. But then, of course, when the number of songs uploaded to a streaming service increase, the per stream payout for an individual artist decreases because the total revenue pool is divided by a larger number of streams, right? And the number of songs have really exploded in the past 5-10 years. A few years ago, I remember being shocked to read that there were 50,000 new tracks being uploaded to Spotify every day. Wow. Well, that number has tripled since then. There are at least 150,000 tracks uploaded a day to Spotify and other streaming services. Just last week, I read that the French streaming service Deezer announced that fully 50,000 AI-generated tracks are uploaded to its service every day. So AI-generated tracks now make up 1/3 of all the songs uploaded to Deezer daily. So musicians have always struggled to, you know, stay visible or be heard over all the new music that's released every day. And they've always struggled to compete against all the old music that's available, because people still love listening to old music. And actually, something like 70% of all the music that's listened on streaming services is called catalog, like it's older music, because of course, we still go back to the music from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And so they've always had to compete against not only other contemporaries, but also the entire history of recorded music. But now they're also competing against this growing tide of AI music that's out there.
I'm curious how this links to your research. I mean, that sounds super recent. The fact that the platforms are being flooded with AI-generated music seems like a relatively recent phenomenon. And I'd love to hear more about the ways in which your research delves into that or other topics.
Yeah, let me tell you a bit about this study that we did on Korean indie musicians and how they're dealing with today's platform world. So we published the article called Platform Closure and Creator Creep in the International Journal of Communication. And South Korea is a really interesting place to look at because, like I said earlier, music platformization hit there earlier and harder than in many Western countries. So big music entertainment and the tech companies in South Korea are vertically integrated. So they involved in production, distribution, and promotion. And they have a lot of control over who gets seen and heard on the main Korean music streaming platforms. So what we found is that this has led to what we called platform closure. So that means the big music and tech companies increasingly decide which artists get visibility on streaming services. So if you are a small indie act, it's very hard to break through on those closed platforms because the bigger artists that are signed to big entertainment companies get more or most of the visibility. What do Korean indie musicians do then? So we found that they are shifting their focus away from streaming services and actually toured more social media like YouTube, TikTok, and the South Korean live streaming platform they call Africa TV. But just last year, they changed the name to Soup. So a lot of indie artists have basically decided, hey, we don't actually need the big Korean streaming platforms anymore. So they are pouring their energy into YouTube and other social media platforms where they feel that at least they have a chance to build an audience without going through gatekeepers. But this is important, actually. In order to succeed on these social media platforms, they have to think about their music differently. So they treat their music not as an albums or songs, but as a content that they can be sliced up and fed into algorithms. So they have to break their songs into different parts designed for particular platforms. So maybe a hook that works as a TikTok or a little part of a chorus that fits a short YouTube video clip. So, and then they need to complement their music by uploading non-musical content on a regular basis, like short videos of their everyday lives and routines or something like that.
Right. Yeah. And this is where I think things get really interesting. A lot of these musicians now feel like they have to act like YouTubers or content creators, right? They record vlogs, they share cooking videos. I just talked to a musician yesterday who, you know, started releasing content on TikTok, and then he found that his audiences actually really like it when he shares food with them that he likes to eat or likes to make. So he's started doing this as well. So they stream themselves doing this. They stream themselves making their music, like behind the scenes videos, or opening up their everyday lives to fans. So some of the artists we talked to for this article that Sanok just mentioned, they really lean into this and they see this as a way of expanding what it means to be a musician or an artist. They like this sort of two-way real-time interaction with audiences that they can get on Twitch and YouTube and that they can't get on traditional streaming platforms. But others that we talked to found this really exhausting and intrusive. They don't want to turn their entire lives into content. They don't want to invite fans into the creative process. And for some of them, this feels just like extra work piled on top of their the work they really want to do, which is making music. So we call this broader process creator creep. And this idea comes from the work of Sophie Bishop, who wrote about influencer creep. She talks about the tactics of influencers creep into all different types of work, right? And in Korea, we really see something similar happening. The practices of YouTube content creators creep into the working lives of the indie musicians that we researched. So if you want visibility as an indie musician, you can't just be a musician. You have to be a creator, you have to be an editor, a streamer, or a personality. And like I said, this shift doesn't benefit everybody equally. It tends to benefit musicians who are already comfortable on the camera, who may have skills in video production, or who are plugged into broader creative scenes where they can collaborate with filmmakers, mm-hmm. designers, and other artists. The other ones, the ones who don't fit into this category, tend to get left behind or they simply burn out. While South Korea is its own specific context, I think it's a glimpse of where things are heading everywhere. And one of the questions I'm really curious about is what happens to creativity when musicians are expected to also become content creators or influencers, right? And I think Korean musicians, and particularly Korean indie musicians, are at the front line of platformization. They're moving away from music streaming platforms, reshaping their music and their daily routines to fit social media and live streaming platforms, and increasingly living like content creators with all the opportunities and the pressures that this brings.
Yeah, I know some of your research has kind of focused on how this experience of being a musician actually even differs across cultures and economies. So it's not just having to wear different hats and be a musician, but welcome people into their creative process, maybe as an influencer or posting TikTok videos. But like the fact that that practice even varies depending on where you are and how the music industry and infrastructure looks, what does that look like? And what have you discovered through your research comparing this across cultures?
Right. So part of my ERC project involves a survey, and we did a survey in the past year of almost 1,200 musicians across five countries. So we looked at musicians in Brazil, in the Netherlands, in Nigeria, in South Korea, and in Chile. And we really wanted to understand how different national contexts affect, you know, the everyday working lives of musicians. And overall, we found some similarities in general. Satisfaction with streaming and the royalties they receive from streaming is very rare. It's hard to find musicians who are happy with it. But Brazilian musicians and musicians in Nigeria were generally a little bit more positive about streaming. Musicians in the other three countries, Chile, the Netherlands, and South Korea, were generally more dissatisfied. One of the several paradoxes we found is that Afrobeats musicians in Nigeria reported some of the lowest incomes, but they also showed some of the highest levels of income satisfaction amongst our surveys. So we were trying to figure out why this is so. We did some follow-up interviews, and it seems like the Nigerian music industry before streaming had some extreme barriers for musicians. It was really difficult to get your music out there unless you really knew someone or you had connections. So streaming and social media, despite the very low payments from these platforms, at least allowed these Nigerian Afrobeats musicians to get their music out and be heard. There weren't many gender differences, but we did find some gender differences amongst Brazilian musicians. Female musicians there were more likely to say that streaming had made things better or stayed about the same, while Brazilian men, male musicians, were more likely to say that streaming had made things worse. And follow-up interviews there, it seems to some extent streaming has disrupted the quote-unquote old boys network in Brazil, where you had to really know someone in order to get your music heard at a label or a radio station to get played. We also found, you know, what you could call streaming's paradox of importance. Lower income artists, musicians who were receiving less money from streaming, generally tended to say that streaming was more important in their careers than musicians that were earning more money. And I think this is because we found that musicians who were successful, at least financially successful, had learned how to diversify. They weren't as reliant on streaming. These tended to be musicians that their careers started before streaming really became mainstream, so generally before 2015, and a smaller share of their overall income was generated from streaming, while musicians who were newer, younger, and maybe relied on streaming more, they, you know, had demonstrated lower incomes. There's also something we call the DIY ceiling, although the general folk wisdom is that you can do everything on your own nowadays, which is partly true. You can record an album at home and you can have it uploaded to all the major streaming services by the afternoon. It still really benefits you to be signed to a label. Musicians who were signed to a label generally had higher income. We also looked at, you know, how the artists we talked to across these different countries, how they felt about promotion, how they felt about communicating with their fans. Nigerian artists tend to communicate the most with their fans. They spend the most, you know, the bigger part of their day communicating with fans. They automate fan communication more than other countries, where they would use certain services to automate communication with fans. And they had the most positive attitudes towards promotional work and relating to their fans. Well, musicians in the Netherlands and South Korea tend to spend less time communicating with their fans and tended to have less of an enthusiastic sort of response to the question of, you know, how they felt about communicating with fans. And this goes with genres as well, because I really see genres as different worlds, right? Whether you're a pop musician or an indie art musician, you have different values, you have different ideas about how you should relate to your fans. And we could really see that Afrobeats artists, for example, R&B, pop, hip-hop artists tended to spend more time communicating with fans, while jazz, rock, indie, or folk musicians tended to spend less time. So different genres really demonstrate different ways of relating to fans. But in general, the biggest difference I think we could see in these five countries is that Nigerian artists really stood out. They checked their metrics most often. They spent most time doing promo. They were more optimistic about income or that they could receive from a streaming, even though they tended to receive far less income from streaming than other artists. And they were more likely to see communication with fans as a creative practice, part of their overall sort of role of being an artist. So the big picture across these five countries is that there isn't just one single story about streaming. Different national contexts, different genres, different generations of musicians have different experiences. So all of these artists are trying to make sense of platforms that they depend on. They sometimes resent these platforms, and occasionally they manage to find a way to bend these platforms to their own purposes.
The thing that I'm thinking about here is creativity. And backpedaling to what you shared earlier, when a musician is expected to do promo and make TikTok videos and engage with fans and track their metrics and basically do all the things that maybe they didn't kind of like sign up to do as a traditional musician, what happens to their creativity?
Yeah, it's a really difficult question to answer and something we're looking into increasingly as we go and in our interviews. Some of the musicians say that it enhances creativity. They have to think very creatively about what it means to be a musician in this contemporary era. And they try new strategies. They collaborate, as I said, with filmmakers. They collaborate with other content producers. But this is often genre-specific. Some hip-hop artists that we talked to in Korea were like this. Mm-hmm. But most of the artists we talked to, they still prefer their creativity to be expended upon the actual music themselves, and they feel like it's a drain to their creativity.
I found that, you know, when we did the research on Korean indie musicians, actually I saw the generational differences as well.
Yeah. Right.
So a little bit older generation, you know, more used to the traditional concept of making music, they think that their creativity got violated or, you know, that kind of feeling. But I see that the younger generation, like early, let's just say early 20s or something until like early 30s or something like that, they feel, although it's a little bit extra work, but I think that they have a little bit different approach, I guess. They kind of accept. And they think that is a part of the music making. Mm. So I think
what
we're
really noticing is that the definition of what it means to be a music artist or an artist in general is changing alongside the rise of these platforms and what is expected of you.
So if we kind of zoom out here, I mean, why is all of this important for us to understand as we commute every day and put our headphones in and listen to Spotify or what have you?
Yeah, I would say music is not a side issue. It shapes, you know, culture, memory, identity, and how people relate to each other. So music is everywhere, and then it grows with us all the time, right? So it is the part of our culture, part of our life. So in this sense, if the people who make music are forced into, you know, more precarious and exploitive arrangement with the platforms, that actually tells us something about how we value cultural work and by extension, other form of care and knowledge work as well.
Yeah, and I also study musicians because they're kind of an extreme example of what platforms are doing to work more broadly. So music was the first sector to suffer the effects of digitalization and the internet, you know, 25 years ago. It's also one of the first sectors to be fully reorganized around streaming, social media, and now AI. So I think musicians are experience the kinds of pressures that other creative producers and maybe other workers in general are feeling, but they experience it earlier on. So this type of massive overproduction, collapsing pay, dependence on opaque algorithms, and the sort of expectation of constant self-promotion. To answer your question, musicians matter here not just because we care about music, although we should, but because they make visible a set of dynamics that are spreading across many different types of work. The need to be constantly online, to pay attention to your performance metrics, or to, you know, to treat every interaction as content. So I think if we can understand what platforms are doing to musicians, we can get a much clearer picture of what they're doing to labor more generally.
And I wonder if there are any kind of budding musicians who are listening to this episode, what can they learn from what you've researched and discovered about what it means to be a musician in 2025 and beyond?
I would say there are a number of lessons. Maybe first of all, don't build your house on streaming, right? Treat streaming as infrastructure. You know, maybe you can see it as a shop window where you can display your work, but don't treat it as your main business model. Get your music out there, but don't assume that more streams are going to solve all of your problems. As I said earlier, the musicians who are doing it best are the ones who diversify, the ones who are doing live shows, who are teaching, who are composing for others. And learn to diversify earlier. The earlier you build multiple ways to earn from music, the less trapped you'll feel when one platform changes its rules, as they always do. Another thing that, you know, comes out of our survey is really understand the limits of DIY. Being fully independent is great, but often means that you have to take on more work. So try to get some support from either a label or a strong manager or join a collective or a scene that can share infrastructure with you. Another lesson I would say is like treat platforms as tools, not as your boss. Learn how they work, but don't let them tell you who you are. So things like fan communication, it's hard work. You're going to be required to do it, but you need to decide consciously how far you want to go and what feels sustainable and authentic for you. For some musicians, as I said, this is part of the creative practice, but for other musicians, this is just a drain. So you really want to know and be honest with yourself of, you know, what type of musician you are. Guard against content creep, right? Like our concept that we developed in that paper, the job of a musician, as we say, can quietly expand into being an editor, an influencer, a streamer, an always-on personality. So set your boundaries early. You know, what parts of your life are public and what parts of your life should remain private, right? What feels like art, what feels like self-extraction. And I think a really important lesson for musicians in the UK is like learn from global differences. Don't just focus on the UK or US models. There are musicians all around the world that are surviving in different contexts, in different scenes. Some of them are sidestepping platforms entirely. There's more than one way to build a career. And I think this is really important in an age of AI. And this is something I've really learned from musicians is really lean into what can't be automated. So put serious care into things that are the hardest to automate. So your live presence, your relationship with listeners, your local scene, your voice, or your particular aesthetic that isn't just chasing trends. So if AI and platforms turn recordings into cheap, abundant content, the scarce things become important, and that's time, attention, trust, and genuine connection.
Last thing I want to say is don't forget, many of the biggest problems musicians face are structural. So join collectives and musicians' unions. Think collectively, just not individually.
And I guess my last question is, for the person who's listening to this podcast on a streaming platform or their music that way, what would you like them to remember every time they open that app or play their favorite song?
Yeah, think consciously about what you're listening to, who made this, who is behind this music. Look into the artist you're listening to. Don't just put on a playlist in the background and have no clue who actually made that music. And try to figure out a way how you can support the artists that you love in other ways. Go to live shows, buy physical recordings, support them on Patreon.
Yep, agree.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Rob and Sunoak, for joining us on this episode of The Human Interface. Make sure to subscribe to be alerted when new episodes drop on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. And follow the Oxford Internet Institute on LinkedIn and Instagram to stay abreast of our latest research and updates. Until the next time.